Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Having been replaced in last week's episode by some bloke called Gordon Murray, I'm afraid I'm back for this week's podcast. Andrew, we've got lots of different cars that we're going to sort of review throughout this podcast. But before we get stuck into that, I just want to debrief on last week's episode of the podcast that you recorded with Gordon Murray, because it was fascinating just to listen to on the podcast. It must have been brilliant to have been there in the same room with him and poke around the T50 that he was talking about as well.
Yeah, first of all, hello everybody. Good to have you back, Dan. It was quite good to have Gordon last week, but yes. Back to normal. It's like, I can't remember where I wrote this, but it's, you know, talking to Gordon Murray is like sort of being in a really polluted city and then getting a cable car out of town to the top of a mountain where the air is suddenly fresh and clear, and you've just got rid of all the rubbish. And sometimes you kind of think to yourself, well, why can't I see as clearly as he sees? Because when he explains it, it's so obvious.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know why nobody else has been able to do a 650 horsepower car which weighs less than a ton. I suspect it's rather expensive, but just the clarity of the vision and the fact that, you know, he thinks to himself, okay, I want to build a 650 horsepower car and I want to weigh less than a ton, but I also want it to seat three people and I want it to have lots of luggage space and I want it to be quiet and I want it to be comfortable. It needs to have air conditioning, it needs to have a decent navigation system, and I'll still do all that and I'll still bring it in under a ton. And he, I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, we haven't driven it yet. No one's stuck it on any scales yet, but he appears to have done it. And it's, you know, there's been so much, you know, as I'm sure many people know, we weren't the only people to have spoken to Gordon in the last few days. But so many of our colleagues, you know, Gordon tends not to speak to people. He doesn't sort of know, like, and respect. And, you know, so, you know, everybody who's spoken to Gordon, you know, has been someone who really kind of gets it. And we're all sort of saying the same sort of thing, that it's just the clarity of the vision that the man has. I was also much struck by the fact that, you know, it's called the T50 because it's his 50th design in 50 years in, you know, automotive design of one form or another. And you kind of think that, you know, Gordon's 74 now, and you kind of think, well, you know, maybe it's pipe and slippers time for him now. I'm not a bit of it. I mean, he is raring to go.
His 50th design seems to be as ambitious as any of the others, doesn't it, really? It's extraordinary.
Yeah, and if it is what it seems to be, and, you know, and if you look at all the people who are involved with it, like, you know, Cosworth and X-Track and so on and so forth, there's no real reason to think that it won't be. You know, I genuinely think that this in, you know, well, 2022 will be when customers start getting cars, could be, you know, another sort of landmark moment like the F1 was in 1994. And who would have thought that the same bloke would be responsible for both? No, it is remarkable. It really is.
I think what's at the heart of it, actually, thinking about it now, is that he's not interested in raw performance stats or lap times or any of that stuff. He prioritises the way that a car feels to drive on the road at normal speeds as well as at, you know, ballistic speeds. And that's at the heart of everything that he does. So he only needs certain width tyres. He only needs brakes so big. He only needs all that other stuff, which is how you start that virtuous circle of a car getting smaller and lighter and simpler. And you look at everybody else in the game, and they all brag about lap times, performance figures, top speeds. And that seems to be at the heart of what makes those cars bigger, heavier, more complicated, and ultimately, although we haven't driven the T50 yet, sort of less engaging on the road in the real world.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's not even that he's not interested in it. He's actively anti it for all those reasons that you express, because he will tell you that the moment you start chasing, you know, Vmax, and the moment you start chasing lap time, you're actually working against and creating cars that are contrary to, you know, to what we should all be wanting cars to be, which is just great to drive. And for him, there's no further justification required. You know, the car just has to be great to drive. That's it. Okay, and then you think, okay, so how do we do that? And as he once said to me, cut me and I bleed Lotus. And the first job he ever applied for was at Lotus in the when he first came to the UK in the early 1970s. And he didn't get a job, but he got one at Brabham. But yeah, Lotus is where his heart is. And more to the point, Colin Chapman's style of engineering is what is, you know, lifeblood to Gordon Murray. And it just shows through, because if you want to make a car good to drive, more than anything else, you just make it light. And that is why, you know, I think that people have been going in the wrong directions. And that is why, you know, two-ton Bugattis and that sort of thing, I just struggle to get excited about it. It's also one of the reasons I am concerned about 2,000 horsepower, two-ton electric hypercars. Because, you know, I'll wait until I drive them if anyone's kind enough to let me. But I just don't see how you can synthesize that feel that you get from, you know, a car like, I imagine, the T50 is going to be, and certainly like the F1 was. So, yeah, it's going to see Gordon is a breath of fresh air, and long may I continue to do it.
I hope that if this car, the T50, has any legacy at all, it's that it demonstrates that there are plenty of buyers out there for very, very expensive £2 million plus supercars, hypercars, but also more real world stuff that actually aren't fussed about enormous power outputs and acceleration figures and so on. I just think McLaren's Mike Fleur is on record already as saying that he can't see McLaren Automotive stepping aside from the horsepower race. And I just love the idea that someone, Gordon Murray, has come along with this car that he's going to, after tax, it's going to be £3 million or something, isn't it?
Well, 2.36 before tax, so you do the maths. Yeah, it's going to be plenty.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and it's got a paltry 660 horsepower. I think some of the established supercar makers wouldn't dare release a £2-3 million vehicle like that with anything less than 1,000 horsepower.
Yeah, I think the point I would make, particularly from what Fluitt has indeed gone on the record and said, that the reason he says that is not because McLaren doesn't want to make cars like that. It's just, you know, any car manufacturer has to make the cars it believes its customers want to buy. And I think the fear is that it's such a... Oh, it's such a binary thing, isn't it? You know, you have to, I mean, a car has to have more power than the last. And the problem is, as you know, the moment you give a car more power, then you make it heavier because it's got to have bigger brakes and it's got to have bigger tyres and bigger wheels and more robust suspension. And on. And then you get into, you know, whatever the opposite of the virtuous circle you describe is. And I guess where Gordon is lucky or has put himself in a fortunate position is he doesn't have to play that game because ultimately he has to sell 125 cars. And he knows that there are enough people out there, particularly with his reputation, who will do that. So he doesn't have to play that game. He can just say, okay, guys, this is the car I want to buy. I'm Gordon Murray. Sorry, this is a car I want to create. I'm Gordon Murray. Is this a car you want to buy? And of course, there are at least 125 unbelievably wealthy people in the world who'll go, yeah, of course, bring it on, because it's Gordon Murray. This is the man who designed world championship winning Formula One cars, the man who designed the F1. His credentials speak for themselves. Now, you know, a normal car manufacturer, even an abnormal car manufacturer like McLaren or Ferrari, you know, needing to sell, you know, not 100 or so cars, but thousands of cars, it's different, isn't it?
Yeah, you're quite right. And yeah, and they have to iterate and come up with new models, and they seem to believe that those new models have to be faster than the last, as you've suggested. And that's how that cycle begins, I suppose. I just hope that the philosophy behind the T50 eventually rubs off on others. In some ways, it's a shame that this fascinating new car's come along, and it's so out of our stratosphere, you know, it's so far beyond that we'll be lucky if we ever drive one.
Do you not think, and this is what makes me fear that the T dot, I don't know what the dot's for, the T dot 50 is, you know, isn't going to lead to a wholesale reevaluation of things in the same way that the F1 didn't? Because if you look at those manufacturers who have tried to do what you have suggested and build cars that aren't interested in, you know, lap times, but are just there to be driven. And you own one of them. Let us not forget your lovely A110. But I'm also thinking about things like the GT86 Toyota and things like that. You know, they've not done brilliantly well.
Hmm. Sadly, I think it's a relatively small number of people who actually prioritize that sort of thing. And, you know, a small number of people is fine if you're charging 2.3 million, isn't it? You know, you only need 100 or 125 of them.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Well, there we go. There were also so many little nuggets in that episode that you recorded with Gordon that it occurred to me would have made fascinating DN posts in themselves. I'm thinking, he spilled the beans on that BMW sports car, supercar that almost was, but wasn't, a mid-engine 2+2 thing, 1,000 cars per year, much more affordable than the F1, 1,100 kilograms, signed off by the BMW board.
And then Ron goes and does a deal with Mercedes, and you know, not entirely surprisingly, they went, well, see ya.
Yeah, just brilliant. Amazing that we were denied that car. And amazing as well to hear Murray talk about the SLR and how that turned out the way it did.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, all the things that clearly... I mean, actually, he was quite good, because I was about to say all the things that he was never able to say at the time. But in fact, he did say pretty much all that stuff at the time, but obviously on an off-the-record basis, and we couldn't report it. But yeah, interesting. It was, you know, we sat down for an hour. It could have been two, but we'd already been together just poring over the car and its engine and everything else for, you know, at least an hour and a half before that. And I think I was booked to see him 45 minutes, and he just kept on cancelling meetings. And I cancel that one. It was just great. It was terrific.
That's brilliant. And you can see why, having had that experience of designing the SLR, which seemed to be a process, you know, of committee, why he's getting back to the more autocratic approach that seemed to have worked so well with the F1 that he's now applied to the T50. It's just the way he works, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, I guess, again, it would be more difficult if you're, you know, trying to sell thousands of cars. I think you have to have a more collegiate approach. But, you know, when you have a mind that is that clear and a vision which is that strong, you don't really want anything to get in the way of it, do you? And, you know, and I don't think that Gordon's ever been particularly good at doing what he's told. He does what he wants to do, and let the results speak for themselves. I can't wait to drive it.
Yeah, same. One last word on this topic, but maybe Gordon Murray's thing is that he's very, very good when he you know, he's building or designing a car that will only sell in very, very small numbers, because he can be autocratic and he can make the final call and never compromise on the final vision. But when he's tasked to build a car that, you know, is produced in bigger numbers, the SLR happens.
Yeah, well, maybe, but you know, that was Mercedes' car, and that was McLaren, you know, working to a Mercedes brief, and you know, the SLR was a, you know, and Gordon will defend aspects of it.
It was
a fascinating car at the time. But you know, I think those people are like that. I mean, you know, I can't, you know, stray too far from what's been published, but I don't think it's a great secret that, you know, that Aston Martin and Adrian Newey, I think Adrian's view of what the Valkyrie should be and Aston Martin's view of what they knew it needed to be a homologated legal road car. I think it is fair to say that there were some fairly frank exchanges of view that went on that subject. And, you know, you can absolutely defend both positions. But, you know, guys like Gordon and Adrian are just used to running the show and saying what they think the way should be, and then that happening, and you know, it's never going to be pretty if somebody else turns up and goes, well, actually, you know, there's these things called, you know, technical regulations, or we've got to sell thousands of them, you know, whatever it is that gets in the way of that. So, you know, I think these guys, as Gordon I suspect is probably about to prove, are just best when left to doing absolutely what they want to do, and then just going to an incredibly, you know, small number of people who are rich enough to be able to afford it.
Yeah, there we go. So we just need to drive the thing now and save up £2.3 million plus taxes. Okay, well, let's move on to the car reviews then, because you can tell that no new cars were launched to the media for several months because, well, the corks come out of the bottle and they're coming thick and fast. We've got a few to talk about. We'll start off with the Aston Martin DBX because, well, the embargo lifts today. So it's sort of, in a sense, the newest car. But we're also going to talk about the Defender because we've already spoken about it on this podcast because you drove it before lockdown. But I've driven it recently, so I think we can have another chat about it. I think you're going to give a bit of a shooing to the Mini John Cooper Works GP, which I'm looking forward to. And then we'll a couple of other supercars that we might well come on to. So DBX, let's start with a little bit of context. Aston Martin, of course, they'll never say if it's life and death for the company, that, you know, the success or otherwise of this car. But Aston Martin, in its current form, given its current financial struggles, I mean, it's crucial, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is absolutely crucial. I mean, the thing about Aston Martin, and, you know, I've written a book about this, so I've been right back to the get-go. I mean, Aston Martin first went bust in 1925, and it's done it fairly regularly, or it did it fairly regularly. You have to be careful what you say here, because Aston Martin hasn't gone bust, and, you know, and you mustn't say that it is. But, you know, it's had a lot of owners. It has had the most extraordinary up and down life, and often it has survived more on sort of charm and character and tradition than it has on the ability of its cars. Now, I wouldn't say that's the case today, but the point I would try to make is that Aston Martin is just one of those brands that apparently you just can't kill. You know, I can remember Victor Gauntlett, who I'm sure many people listening to this will remember as one of the sort of more charismatic Aston Martin chairmen. He once told me that there are two occasions when he went to the office in the morning expecting to lock the factory gates as he left that evening. He couldn't see a way that it would survive. And yet here we are, decades later, and there is Aston Martin. And the other point I would make is, you know, whatever its troubles and whatever the cause of those troubles, you know, the product is good. You know, I would say they have the strongest product lineup now that they've ever had, certainly in the time that I've been doing this job. And, you know, I think that there is a lot to play for. But yes, no question at all, they are in desperate, desperate trouble, and the DBX has to work. It's odd, isn't it, that, you know, Aston Martin finds itself in a situation where, you know, this most blue-blooded of British sports car manufacturers needs to be rescued. It's relying on a, you know, whatever it is, a 2.1-ton SUV to save it. But that appears to be where we are at the moment.
Yeah, it's a very good point, because in the past, as we've spoken about before, Aston Martin has been saved by the DB7. It's been saved by the DB2. And now, as you, yeah, it's a huge high riding SUV that with any luck, is going to secure the sort of future stability of the market. Yeah, it really is a sign of the times.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, and to be fair, you know, there's precedent. Look what the Cayenne did for Porsche. You know, there were lots of people, myself included, gosh, you know, who were. I can remember writing that however impressed I was with the car, I just wished it had never been built. And, you know, how wrong did I get that? Because, of course, what I failed to appreciate was the relationship between the Cayenne and the Porsches that I love to drive, because one had paid for, the SUVs paid for the 911s and so on and forth, and the 911s gave the SUVs the credibility they needed to be sold in the first place. And it's a remarkably strange yet harmonious relationship. And who's to say that, well, thick end of 20 years on, the DBX can't do the same for Aston Martin?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I think you're right. So you drove an early pre-production prototype a little while ago. You've since driven a production car. Had the car evolved at all, or was it just sort of better panel fit and stuff?
Well, I mean, you know, the first drive was a bit of a wing and a prayer, to be honest with you. The truth is, I bumped into them on a hill and on a mountain somewhere in Wales where they were doing some photography, and I just went, "Git a go," and they went, "Well, can't right now because you might get seen. But if you turn up at the factory tonight when it's dark, you can have a quick run around the block," which is literally what I did. So I drove it in horrible weather, in pitch black, for probably 40 minutes. And so I wouldn't say that I got a sort of reliable data point from that at all. But from what I could tell, I don't think it had changed very much. I mean, the car was a lot less rough around the edges, but I mean, the powertrain was the powertrain and the chassis was the chassis. And, you know, when I drove it recently, I suspect like you, I got a decent amount of time in the car. I mean, I actually had it for a couple of days. I drove it on road. I actually drove it around track. I've had a proper go in it now. So it's difficult to relate one experience to the other. But it was largely what I expected. But, you know, more to the point, what did you think of it?
I thought it was what it needed to be. I think it's very good, actually. I think it does what it needs to do. I think the car will sell because it's an SUV and they're just so popular, because it's an Aston Martin and that brand still has some sort of cachet, and because it looks much better than a Bentayga. But I think it does more than just sort of tick those few boxes, because I think it's really good to drive. I think it's got massive performance. The engine sounds characterful, particularly in the sportier modes. I think it's got that sort of what's becoming a typical Becca ride quality, sort of connected, controlled, but
compliant.
Compliant enough to deal with bad surfaces.
Yeah.
That seems to be the way he likes it. So it's not, you know, if you come out of a Range Rover or a Bentayga and you're used to that very fluid, sort of conspicuously air-sprung, lolloping body movement that smothers the roads, you know, you might think that the Bentayga, the DBX rides a bit firmly, it's a little bit jiggly, but I think it's what it needs to be, given that it's an Aston Martin. And then, you know, it handles lots of these cars because they're littered with clever chassis hardware, you know, those trick air springs and active anti-roll bars and four-wheel drive systems that can do clever stuff. They're all really impressively agile, given their height, given their weight. And this is sort of right up there with them. So I'm absolutely not in the market for a 2.2-ton, you know, £160,000, whatever it is, SUV. But if I was, I think my money would be going to Aston Martin.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I do agree. I mean, I'd go a bit further. I think the chassis is remarkable. And I only say this because I've done the one thing that no owner will ever do. And I've punted it round a track. But more than that, I've driven it hard cross country. And to me, you know, it does all what you say it does, for all the reasons that it does it with a clever chassis control. But to me, there's a feel there. A feel you just don't expect to get in a 2.2-ton SUV, and a balance as well. It really doesn't, understand. You know, I found myself sort of, you know, just going sideways everywhere in it, which I know people won't do and everything else. But it is indicative of the approach that they've taken, and I think the balance that they have achieved between its ride and its handling is actually, by a distance, the best I have come across in a car of that kind. Which, and when you consider that Cayenne's in there, I think to me that gives some sense of the scale of achievement. You know, so I think it's got that going for it. I think obviously it's got a great name going for it. I love the way that some people, when I tweeted something about it, said that they didn't like the way it looked at all, which surprised me slightly because, okay, fine, it's a big SUV and, you know, people, myself in particular, aren't huge fans of that particular genre of car. But I think among that genre, I can't think of a car that is anything like as good looking. But I mean, I did have some reservations about it. You know, commercially, I think the lack of a hybrid is definitely going to hurt them, because I think there are just markets in the world where, you know, you need to you need to have a plug-in. And one of my hopes is that now that Tobias Merz, the ex-AMG boss, is installed at Aston Martin, that he's going to be tapping up his chums in Stuttgart and hastening that process as soon as possible. I also, and this is a complaint that people have made about Aston Martin's quite a lot of late, is however good the outside is, I just don't think that the interior is quite up to that standard. And of course, you can spend a lot of money slathering it in expensive leathers and bits of trim and everything else, and you can certainly raise its game. But fundamentally, the interior architecture is not as good as I would like it to be. And they're still, although they've tried quite hard to reface things, it's still a bit too much, obviously, parts bin Mercedes-Benz in there. Would you agree?
Absolutely agree. I think also, I wonder if we had the same car, but my car was in that deep red colour with a very caramel interior. Everything
we had the same car
in caramel leather. And I think that really didn't flatter the interior at all. I've seen other specs that looked a bit better. But I was sort of unimpressed, unmoved by the cabin. I thought it was okay. I thought it was fine, average for the class, really. Which actually isn't quite good enough, is it?
Not for an Aston Martin, no. You know, people always forget, you actually spend, you know, what, 100 times more time looking at the inside of a car than the outside if you own it. And it's nice to soak up the stairs from the pavement. But actually, you know, you do just want to, and it's not bad. You know, it's not like a sort of, I don't know, a 1980s Ferrari or something. It's not, you know, it's not sort of Fiat Uno bits here and there, but it's, it just kind of, yeah. And I understand that, you know, that they haven't got the money to do all their own stuff or they've got better things to spend that money on. But, you know, we have to report as we find. And yeah, it was, it's not as good as I would like it to be.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I completely agree with you. I think in terms of ride and handling, what I much prefer the way it feels in GT mode, which is actually the default mode. And I spoke to Becker about this, and he explained that he also said that that's his favourite mode. So from there, you can go into Sport or Sport Plus, and the car obviously becomes increasingly sort of locked down and tauter the sportier you go.
But why would you in a car like that?
And it's partly because the active anti-roll system has been configured so that in GT mode, there's a natural amount of body roll in corners, which is what allows you to feel a car working beneath you.
Absolutely. That is why, you know, for instance, with Porsche, with their, you know, when you, what do they call it, PDCC, their active damper
absolutely.
Control. I've never understood why anybody would spend money on it.
Absolutely,
you know,
agree.
I had a long-term 991 Gen 2 Carrera S for a bit, which had it. I think I tried it once, and I never touched the button again. And those Mercedes that do the sort of pendolino bit, where they actually lean into a corner, again, that's something that you try once and think, I'll never do that again. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You want particularly cars that are high and heavy like that, because otherwise what happens is instead of the car moving, you move. And so you'll find yourself, yeah, the car doesn't shift an inch and you're being thrown around the cabin and it's just not nice.
It's unnatural, isn't it?
Yeah, completely.
Did you drive it off-road?
Well, there is what you would call an off-road route at Aston Martin's base at Silverstone, and there's not a car in the world with four-wheel drive which wouldn't have got over it with ease. So yes, I did. I probably drove it more off-road than any owners would. But in fact, you know, the off-road test you want to put that car to is, you know, is towing a horse box across a muddy field. or dragging a racing car behind it, you know, across, you know, some grassy paddock at some, you know, windswept race circuit somewhere.
Or a snowy ski resort.
Or a snowy ski resort, yeah. I mean, those are the challenges that DBXs, I hope, are put to. And I suspect that as long as it's got the right rubber on it, and as long as everybody remembers it'll only tow 2.7 tonnes, not 3.5 tonnes, I suspect within those limitations it'll be absolutely fine. Because why wouldn't it be?
Yeah, I did some slightly more serious off-roading at Millbrook.
Okay.
And it's capable, you know. It'll do, on only mud and snow tyres, it will do way more off-roading than I suspect any owner will ever require of it.
Yeah, so it's good enough.
Yeah, it's good enough in that sense. If you need any more off-road ability than that, I suspect you're a hobbyist off-roader. In which case, you're not going to be buying a DBX, are you? So,
is this how we segue seamlessly into the Defender?
Well, I wasn't going to, but now that you've said, we should. That was smooth as silk there.
Yeah.
Oh, we're good at this. Okay, so as I mentioned, we have already discussed the Defender, but I think I wanted to revisit it because I've now driven it. And I come at this car from a very different perspective to you, Andrew, because you still own the series Land Rover that you passed your driving test in.
I do.
So the Defender must have, you know, a big place in your heart, whereas I've never really given a damn about them.
Yeah.
So I suspect we approach them very differently.
So, well, we do and we don't, you know, because, well, I mean, I've written about the car and, you know, people who have listened to this podcast or spent time reading Deanne on Instagram will know. But the Defender that is today, it's not the new Defender. It's got the name, but it's a different car. And in fact, to me, that's not actually a bad thing at all, because what it is to me is the replacement for the old Discovery, which was another car of which I have, you know, huge fondness. And I think it does that job fantastically well. And I think the new Defender is a really, really good car. But I just don't think of it as being the replacement for the old Defender. I suspect the Ineos Grenadier is going to be a much closer, sort of spiritual successor than the new Defender will ever be. But then again, you know, Land Rover needs to sell, you know, hundreds of thousands of these things. And so they had to go where the market is. And I think that given that, I thought that they did. I mean, I would say that it's probably the best Land Rover product I've driven in many years. How about you?
Well, so I just want to ask this. You say that it's more like the replacement for the Discovery. Is that because you think the current Discovery has gone too upmarket, it's too
absolutely
expensive?
100%. And it's too glitzy, it's too glamorous. It's much too close to the Range Rover. It blurs the line between a Land Rover and a Range Rover. And more than anything else, until the Defender came along, it just didn't replace that car. I've got a mate who I just go to the pub with and that sort of thing, who lives locally, who's got, I think it's like a 2011 Discovery, and it's done a million miles and everything. And every time I get into it, I just feel happy. I just look around at all those sort of chunky buttons and the, you know, the hard surfaces, and it just feels real. It just feels authentic. It doesn't feel like it's been styled for some fashion victim audience. And I completely get that that's what Range Rovers are for, but it's not what Land Rovers are for. And that's what I like so much about the Defender. It's recaptured what the current Discovery lost. And like, to me, given that there are Range Rovers out there for people who want to go down that road, it lost much more than it gained. So I'm just really, really happy that the Defender has, you know, recaptured that territory.
I think if they were talking to you off the record, Land Rover would say that the Discovery hasn't quite worked for them, wouldn't they? I think they've acknowledged that it's not selling the way they would like it to.
I think
it's too expensive.
It looks terrible. Probably got a little bit to do with that. But yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so the Defender. So I drove it on roads quite a lot, and also at Eastnor Castle, did some proper off-roading in it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you know, it's a massively capable off-roader, inevitably. I think Land Rover describe it as its most capable car off-road at the moment, which is great. But, you know, I think if you really love off-roading, you want to do more behind the wheel, don't you? I found myself driving through some really tough terrain with one arm on the armrest, leaning back in my seat as though I was on the motorway. And for me, that it's impressive what the car can do, but there isn't any satisfaction or enjoyment in that.
You see, that's very good. You know, we are actually going to disagree about something for once. because I'm a nervous off-roader. I've done a fair bit of it, and I don't think I'm bad at it, but I get twitchy when I'm off-road. And I want a car to, I want to feel that the car's on my side. And you're completely right. I'm not saying that you're wrong in your judgment at all. It's just what doesn't work for you does work for me. The very reasons that you are sitting there thinking, you know, I just wish that I could, you know, choose when to lock my diffs and, you know, and the steering was kicking back and I was having to think harder and frankly get more involved, which is what we all want to do behind the wheel of a car. I'm sitting there thinking, wow, this is just so easy, and thank goodness for that, because I'd have stuck it in a tree by now.
I can completely understand that point of view, and I think the thing is, I'm not an off-road driver either. I think if that's what you really love doing, this isn't the car for you, I don't think. And I don't know who it is that isn't a hobbyist off-roader who finds themselves in that sort of terrain. I mean, I don't really know what that overlap is, to be honest.
But you're going to, you know, if you are a hobbyist off-roader, I mean, are you really going to go and spend whatever it is, £40,000 on a Defender? You're not. It's not really after those people, is it?
No.
You know, you're going to go, you might buy a Grenadier, I guess, but I suspect you're more likely to have some beaten up Defender or, you know, a Suzuki or a pickup or goodness knows what, or even an old, you know, very old Disco. Yeah, that's interesting because that's why it was good off road. The very reason it was bad off road to you was the reason it was good off road to me. Because, you know, I don't think, if I'm honest with you, that if you got the old Defender and a new Defender, I don't think there are many places the new Defender with the right driver and the old Defender with the right driver. So I don't think there are many places that the new Defender could go which the old one wouldn't get to. The difference is if you put drivers, you know, a driver of my kind of ability off-road could probably get to exactly the same place as a professional off-road driver could get in an old Defender. And so it just makes it more accessible if you're going to go and do that with your Defender, which sadly I'm not. I'll tell you one thing I'll say about the Defender, and I always think this with important new cars. I always start just sort of keeping an eye out. I've seen loads of them already. I've seen a lot on the road. There's one a village down from me. I was in Europe doing something last week, and I saw a couple out there. So hopefully, you know, I think that the order books are full, and I know that they're getting out there. So hopefully, it's going to do really well for them.
I really hope it does. If you order today, you'll get it in 4 to 6 months, which is, you know, it means that they've got plenty of orders. They're cranking them out. Presumably the factories were shut down for a little while, but hopefully we'll start seeing more of them appear now. One of the things I really liked about the Defender is that they allow it to feel like an off-roader, even though you could use it every day on the road without compromise, really. It could be a family car without compromise, but you step up into it, you put your hands on this enormous steering wheel that's not a very car-like angle, and the steering is slightly slow. It's not ponderous, but it doesn't have that immediate, instant directness of a car steering rack. The whole body rolls a bit in corner, so it feels like an off-roader, which is it gives it this kind of authentic character. I like
100%. Yeah,
and I think that's probably the advantage of it having A, a Land Rover badge on the front, and B, a Defender badge next to it, you know, rather than if it has a BMW roundel, it has to feel a certain way, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether you managed to do this, but I drove two, actually. And one was on sort of, you know, slightly knobbly all-season tyres, and one was on proper summer tyres. And these were on completely, you know, smooth, you know, fairly, completely dry, warm roads. And I much preferred it on the knobblies.
Yeah, yeah.
I just preferred that that lack of precision, which is a ridiculous counterintuitive thing to say, but it just felt more authentic. And I suspect the car you drove was on the same all-season tyres, because the moment you put it onto, you know, slightly stiffer walled, shorter walled summer tyres, it just felt more like a, you know, like a, you know, any other car, and I liked it less for it.
Yeah, and those knobbly tyres, those more knobbly tyres, they're not, I wasn't aware of them being very noisy on the motorway.
No, they're not. They're absolutely fine.
Do you know what? Whenever you tweet or post on Instagram about the new Defender, your replies are just flooded with comments about they should have done this, I wish it was like that. Everyone's got an opinion on this car, which I think is basically a great thing for Land Rover.
Yeah, 100%.
But what are the sort of criticisms that you keep spotting? I think one of the ones for me is that it's too expensive, which, you know, I understand that criticism. That I drove a 240 engine, the diesel engine, four-cylinder diesel, a 110, so the longer wheelbase, and it was 52k basic, thereabouts, which is, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. But I just don't know how much less they could have charged. What's an entry one? Is it sub 40?
Well, the commercial is 35 grand, isn't it, before tax? And I think an entry car is, I think it's 42, but I might be wrong. Yeah, absolutely. But I think that probably is because they're expecting one car and getting another, because I think what they were maybe expecting or even hoping for is a completely back to basics car. And as you and I both know, it isn't that. It is a perfectly viable everyday car. I'd be delighted to have one every day and to use it in all seasons and for all reasons. And, you know, it's a big car, and it still has sort of Land Rover quality. So, I mean, I'm not sure what they were expecting. I mean, Land Rover were never going to sell that car for 25 grand. It just wouldn't make sense on any level. But what I would say is that as I drove it, I find myself craving the lowest spec possible. It's just one of those cars. I don't want to drive a 60 grand whiz bang 300 horsepower hoojama flip. What I want to drive is a short wheelbase commercial with nothing on it, on knobbly tires. And if I were in the market for such a car, that's what I'd have, because that to me is much more in keeping with the Defender idiom. I know that it would still be good enough to do all the things I needed to do on a daily basis. And it would just be, it goes back to this thing. And I guess it applies as much to the Defender as it does to the T50 Gordon Murray car we were talking about earlier. It just comes back to authenticity, doesn't it? And the more authentic these cars feel, the more we like them, or the more people like you and I like them. But obviously, you know, we also have to recognise that you and I are, and I would suggest the vast majority of people listening to this combined represent a tiny percentage of the demographic of people who'll go and buy that car. And so, you know, I don't think we can say, oh, it should have been like this, because that's how we would like it to have
been.
You know, there will be any number of Defenders, and Land Rover certainly hopes this is the case, that will sell for absolutely top dollar, and will go and live, you know, in central London, and, you know, and they'll just pay the congestion charge or whatever, because it's worth it to those sorts of people to be seen in that kind of car. And you and I may laugh at them, but, you know, Land Rover's accountants certainly won't laugh at them. And, you know, if they sell the cars, they sell the cars. And fair enough.
I think Land Rover has done what it needed to do to make the Defender a commercial success, which actually is, that's its only responsibility, isn't it? That's what the company exists to do.
I only say this because of your use of that word responsibility. I think Defender is a nameplate. You know, it's something that, you know, they've used very successfully. I remember when the first car to actually call itself the Defender was, because the Series 3, I think, went out in about 1983, but then they had 90s and 110s. But let's say Defenders have been around for a bit more than 30 years. I mean, that is now a very valuable nameplate to them, and they can't mess with it. So I think there is a responsibility to do justice to the name beyond the responsibility to also make a car that is commercially successful. And maybe one begats the other, I'm not sure. But I think they've done both, I really do. I mean, you know, it's not the Defender that we remember, but it is an absolutely authentic on off-road Land Rover. And, you know, I commend it for that.
I think the clever thing about it is that it's a very usable... You could absolutely use it as a family car, and it's probably more luxurious as a family car nowadays than, you know, a sort of 20-year-old, 30-year-old Range Rover, you know, given all the equipment it's got and so on and so forth.
Definitely.
But it is authentic. It is still true enough to that name Defender. And hopefully that'll be why it does well. I think one last word on the cost of it. A lot of people I see commenting online seem to think that it should cost 25 grand, 30 grand. And the reality is cars have become more expensive, and that sort of money doesn't really buy you that much VW Golf these days.
No, absolutely right. Absolutely right. And also, you know, Land Rover also have to protect the bigger brand. You know, Land Rover is not a brand which is positioned in that area of the market anymore. And they'd have to make so many of them, which they probably not be able to sell because there are only so many people who want to buy that kind of car. It's just, you know, everything about it from a, God forbid me saying, the marketing point of view, is you know, I would love it to be 25 grand. You know, I might even go and buy one if it were, but, you know, there may be one of me, but, you know, there would be so many reasons. They'd lose money on everyone. So no, I can't, it was never going to happen.
Yeah, there we go. All right, well, let's move on because we've got a couple of other cars to talk about. And mostly because I just want to hear you giving a bit of a shooing to this new Mini John Cooper Works GP, which if anyone's read the car review on Instagram at DriveNation_, I think in the 2 and a bit years we've been doing this, we've awarded a 5 out of 10 rating twice. And this was the second time.
What was the first one?
It was the the VW Polo GTI.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
A pair of underwhelming hot hatches. So did the Mini at any point make you laugh, make you smile?
No, not once.
Make you be pleased to be in it?
No, absolutely not. No, absolutely not once. It annoyed me from the moment I got in it.
Wow. Because cars can be flawed and, you know, a bit silly and whatever and not very competent, but they can also be fun and silly. But this just sounds like it was annoying.
Yeah. I honestly don't know where to start. I mean, you know, the moment you get in it and set off down the road, the ride. I mean, you know, if you do what you and I do for a living, you would pick up on the ride and the deficiencies in the ride and the steering within the first, I was about to say 10 yards, you know, probably 5. And you're already thinking, well, why is it like this? It doesn't need to be like this. I guess what really annoyed me most about it was that the sort of the raw ingredients seem so good. You know, the car is light. It is, by the standards of such sort of things, given it's a limited edition model, it's not even that expensive. It's got plenty of power. And if you look down the spec sheet at all the stuff that they've done to it, you know, with the springs and the bars and the stiffened turrets and the strut braces and the limited slip diff and the forged wheels and the yinging and the yang and so on and so on and so forth, you know, they seem to have made, you know, a really, really big effort for this car. And for what? I mean, it is possible, because I haven't done it, if you took it to a track, it would, you know, blow your mind. I don't think that it would, but it might. I certainly don't completely preclude that possibility. But on the road, it's just a nonsense. It cannot handle its power. If it's not torque steering, it's tramlining. The steering, I suspect, because they've had to try to do something to mitigate the torque steer, has just got no feel to it at all. It's got an 8-speed automatic torque converter gearbox in it. I mean, you know, I am told there was no other way of doing it. But honestly, if ever a car needed a slick, quick 6-speed manual in it, it's that car. But it doesn't. It's got this slushy 8-speeder, which, you know, works terribly well in 320D BMWs, but not in this. And I drove it yesterday, not far, and I then set an alarm, as I wrote in the piece, and got up early because I just thought I'd just missed something or whatever, and went for a proper drive on proper roads in it very early this morning. Before I say this morning, I'm talking about when we recorded this podcast last week. And I, you know, it's a terrible thing to say, but I found myself doing it because I was required to do it to do the job I have to do, not because I wanted to drive the car. I was out there thinking, well, you know, this is the right thing to do. You are doing this because this is a car and you need to drive it in this environment to assess it properly. There wasn't one bit of me that wanted to do it. And that is just for a car like that. And also the other thing, which is so infuriating about it, is I don't know when you last drove a bog standard Mini Cooper or a Cooper S. They're fantastic little things. I love those cars. And actually, I don't think people these days shout about them as much as they used to, because I think, you know, people are so familiar with them and they've kind of done what those sorts of cars have done for the last 20 years. But to me, a standard Mini Cooper is a really good car. And so here you get one turned up not to 11, but about 27. And you think, whoopee, let's go. And it just doesn't work. I can't think of a car which has looked so good on paper, yet disappointed so much on the road.
And I wonder as well, on top of all of that, Andrew, and I think it's quite clear where you stand on the Mini John Cooper Works GP. Do you have a view on how it looks?
Yeah, I do have a view on how it looks. And again, that's completely wrong, because I'm a 54-year-old bloke. And I quite liked it, but my grown-up children, who are rather younger than me, took one look at it and said, "What is that?" And I suspect it's meant to appeal rather more to them than to me. I don't know. I'm not really into cars with lots and lots of chunky add-on bits, and it's got those slightly silly carbon fiber reinforced plastic wheel arch extensions and that enormous rear wing and this, that and the other. But I find myself being curiously unoffended by its appearance, and I'm not quite sure why, but my children would tell you something else.
Wow, there we go. I mean, it's interesting that we started this podcast talking about, okay, a very different car, but one with a very clear purpose. Its creator knew precisely what that car was setting out to be. And it sounds to me like the GP doesn't have that clarity of purpose, but also it's compromised by daft things. You know, they talk about there being no other gearbox option. Well, perhaps that's because they decided for themselves that it needed to have 300 brake horsepower. I've not driven the car, but
I suppose for a car like that, they've only got to sell it's actually quite a large number. They've got to sell 3,000 of these things. And I suppose the thinking was it's got to have a load more power than a standard John Cooper Works. And it's got to have this, that and the other. Otherwise, it won't command credibility. But yeah, I mean, I completely agree. If they'd just been a bit brave and just thought, actually, 300 horsepower, well, instead of having 70 extra horsepower, let's just give it 35 extra horsepower. It had had whatever that is, 265. I think you'd probably had, quite often you can't use all the power anyway, because if you're on, the thing is, this is a car, I'm going to go off again on one. This is a car that's built in Britain, and I'm not coming over all sort of jingoistic and Union Jack over here, but it does surprise me that Car in Britain appears not to have spent a single minute of its development life on British roads, because if it had, it wouldn't be like that, because they would have, whoever did develop it, and I suspect it was developed entirely in Germany, would have just thought, this isn't working, guys. Sorry, we're just going to have to give it a bit more compliance. We're just going to have to sort out the front axle. We're just going to have to either not do it or do it differently, because it's just getting in the way. It's like a chef has got a load of really, really good ingredients and then just sort of bunged them into a saucepan, given them a stir and hoped. And it hasn't come out quite as expected. And,
So, yeah, okay. I think it's quite clear where you stand on this car. So you won't be expecting a long-termer by the sounds of it.
I won't be asking for one. And I don't think, I'm sure. No. I mean, I don't like being, getting gratuitously stuck into things. And I never would unless I truly felt what I said, because I understand that people try hard with all cars that get made, and that, and that livelihoods and all sorts of things, often are influenced by things that people like you and I write. So, you have to be careful and you have to be balanced. And but yeah, I guess because it is so surprising, because it is such a rarity, that you get into a car and you think, well, this is its intended purpose, and it just misses it by a mile, that, you do kind of have to flag it up, because it is mercifully a pretty rare occurrence these days.
I suppose the real frustration is that the less hot Mini Coopers and the Cooper S, they're such fun to drive, aren't they? And
it's, yeah, just drive those, you know.
Yeah.
This thing costs $35,000. Well, I think for like $22,000 you can get a Cooper S. I mean, if they were the same money, I'd drive the Cooper S. I'd drive a Cooper. I mean, those are real, as I said earlier, those are cracking little cars. This isn't.
Okay, well, let's do 2 minutes on one other car now, and I'll let you choose. You can do the revised NSX or F8 Spider.
Let's go revised NSX. You have written about the F8 Spider on Instagram for us, I believe.
Yes, correct.
So I guess that has a Drive Nation presence of some sort. Yeah, revised NSX. I'll talk about it a bit generally because it actually goes back to what we were talking about with the T50 at the beginning of this, because it's the kind of opposite of that. It is a car that, you know, is very complicated, and it's very heavy. It's got it's obviously got a twin turbo 3.5 litre V6 engine in it, but it's also got an electric motor at the back and another two at the front. And all these things would be fine if when you got in it, you would just think this was some kind of, you know, transformative driving experience. And it just isn't. It just isn't. Also, you can see that particularly with things like the interior materials, you know, they spent so much money loading all this tech onto the car that, you know, they've had to kind of, or it certainly appears that they've had to cut corners in other ways. And the result is a car that is certainly capable and not sort of overtly bad in any way that, you know, a Mini GP might be overtly bad. But it just left me cold. I did my usual thing. I took it up into the Welsh mountains and had a proper go in it. And I came out. Was I impressed and did I admire it? I mean, to an extent, but I certainly didn't love it. And I found myself thinking, well, you know, a BMW i8, which is a very similar sort of concept, but so much cleverer because, you know, it's got a carbon tub and you can plug it in and it's got that little three-cylinder engine, but it sounds just as good. And it's got rear seats and, you know, this, that and the other. And the NSX, you know, despite the fact that it has been revised and they have fiddled with the suspension to try to make it a bit more responsive, you know, I understand why it hasn't sold very well because, you know, I think it looks great. The build quality, if not some of the materials they use, is very good. It's quite quiet. It's quite comfortable. I think that, you know, there's not much room in it, particularly luggage space, because that's all given over to electric motors. But, you know, if you weren't going that far or if you're only going away overnight or whatever, it could work for that. But, you know, this is a properly expensive car. It's junior McLaren money. And I just found myself wanting, as a driver, much, much more. And I found that for all that it had, and again, this is, I guess, like the new GP, you know, not only is less more, but more is less. And that's where I was with it. I've had a downer on some cars this week, haven't I?
Well, that's okay. We don't mind that at all. I once again, we're in agreement. I am impressed by the NSX and what it can do. I remember driving one, an earlier car, so long before the facelift, up in Scotland on an Evo Car of the Year, one of those quick drives that you have after sunset on the way back to the hotel, and without terrifying myself, I just romped away from everybody else behind me. There was a very good driver in a 911R. Who just disappeared, and not because, I'm a reasonable driver. I'm not especially skillful, but the car is just so quick. It point to point on the road, it is so fast, but it leaves you cold. You sort of feel like your role is diminished. Even, I think this is one of the things that the Honda people almost brag about, that if you leave the automatic gearbox in the right mode, but in auto, it will shift gear as and when you would yourself with the paddles, which is great. That's very clever. But what's the point in that? You know, you don't even have to change gear for yourself. And it just doesn't give you enough to do at the wheel.
To me, it is a fundamental misunderstanding of what drivers want from cars. This is why I love old cars. and I think I've probably blathered on about this on the podcast before, so I will be very brief. But, you know, you want cars that involve you. You don't want to be sitting in the stalls watching it all happen in front of you. You want to be controlling it. You want to be changing gear. You want three pedals. You want steering to feel alive. You want to feel part of the machine. And the further removed you are from that process by paddles or automatic gear shifts, by electric steering, by cars which are dynamically set up to do it all for you, the less involving the driving experience is. And, you know, I understand why car manufacturers do it that way, because sadly, most people who drive most cars like that aren't that interested in those sorts of things. They're much more interested in what they think that car says about them to their friends, neighbors, families, whatever. But it still saddens me, because, you know, these are cars that purport to be cars for, you know, proper, you know, drivers and enthusiasts. And increasingly with cars like, you know, like the NSX, they're just not. They're really quick, capable, well-built, thoroughly engineered devices. And that's the end of it, really.
Yeah, preach. I'm absolutely in agreement with you there. Okay, well, let's leave that one there. We're in danger of busting the 1 hour mark, aren't we? Okay, thank you, Andrew. We'll be back to talk to you all again next week. And please remember to like the podcast, subscribe, leave a rating, all that good stuff. And also support us on Patreon if you want to. You'll get some exclusive written content from us. That's patreon.com/DriveNation. And thank you for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thanks very much, everyone. I really enjoyed this one, actually. So hopefully we'll do it all again this time next week.
Absolutely. Goodbye.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.